Hello, my name is Amy Ciara, and my pronouns are she and her. And I'm here for this week's edition of Stick Together, the only national program focusing on union news, workers' stories, and social justice issues. This program is produced in Melbourne for 3CR and broadcast across the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation on the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. Today's show is a worker's story. My worker's story. Specifically, my time as a gardener in the open space maintenance industry, working for large multinational maintenance companies. It's my desire on this show to bring episodes to you covering jobs that work with plants and ecosystems. And I thought, why don't we start with my own experiences in gardening and landscaping? So grab your whippy cord and a knapsack full of Roundup and let's get into it. In today's episode of Stick Together, I am going to share my experience as a gardener working in open space maintenance for major multinational contractor companies. Gardening and landscaping is one trade among several trades that should be on the vanguard of green jobs to turn around the climate crisis, undo pollution, and protect life on this planet. It's not just my industry. Workers in conservation and land management could be walking with First Nations people in caring for country and healing it, preventing severe bushfires and maintaining ecosystems on a large scale that support life on this planet. Arborists have skills and knowledge to care for trees and bolster their populations. Trees, which are powerful organisms at sequestering carbon and making our urban environments cooler without the need for air conditioners. Horticulturalists, who instead of mass producing monocultures for globalized mass consumption and big business or degrading our soils with unsustainable agricultural methods, they could be using the knowledge they were taught to make healthy, sustainable food forests with soils that could store billions of tons of carbon from our atmosphere as soil organic carbon safely in the ground. Folks like myself in gardening and landscaping could be delivering cooler suburbs, organic scrubbers to purify the air in our cities, filter the stormwater that runs down our streets, provide decentralized sources of free food, and so much more. However, if you are a worker who left TAFE all starry-eyed, dreaming of these futures like me and my peers, then you would know the shock of the reality of the majority of the work out there. Work that is not about care for country, the environment, our health, or communities, but work that we were taught is bad for those things. This is because the priority of the current system is profit. It's for industries like real estate and mining. It's built on aesthetic ideas that belong to 18th century European aristocracy, appropriate for a continent on the other side of the planet, when our continent has a completely different landscape managed for over 60,000 years. All right, before I get too excited, let's turn now to my personal experience as a gardener in open space maintenance. What is open space maintenance? It is the maintenance done outdoors for facilities, parks, gardens, all the outdoor spaces. Sometimes indoors. I've done some indoor gardens, but generally speaking, it's maintenance that's done outdoors. What does a gardener like me do? Well, the job ad will say a list like lawn maintenance and care, amenities pruning, uplifting trees and care for small trees, litter removal, diagnosing and treating pests and diseases, landscaping, and making horticultural recommendations. I worked for a team as a team leader responsible for some of Melbourne's most high traffic and high profile sites. Not as an in-house worker, but as a worker for a large multinational maintenance company. For these sites, I did all those things from that list I said just a minute ago, whilst maintaining a schedule, however, of over 30 individual sites. Several of those sites, once upon a time, had in-house crews working multiple days. I also did things like clean barbecues, remove graffiti, clean windows, and some minor handy person jobs. This was not clearly defined in the job ad or in our contract's job classification structure, so yes, it is common for workloads and responsibilities to vary widely between people on the same pay. Now, what I have just described to you sounds like I was a skilled technician with a lot of opportunities, but really, I was an exploited technician, and the majority of the work was not that fancy list I read earlier, but maintaining hedgerows, spraying weeds, picking up rubbish, and blowing leaves off footpaths, which was fine. And the truth is that whatever kind of gardening you do, it is repetitive and fairly unadventurous, but it still makes a really nice job. It can be quite enjoyable not to have to think too hard, and it can be relaxing outdoors and, you know, good for your physical health. You know, if you're not just trying to manage 30 different sites and keep them in your head all day. I've also worked in what the majority of the industry is like outside the ritzy inner city suburbs. I've worked in various outer suburbs where the majority of the work is mowing, spraying weeds, landscaping, rubbish removal, and maintaining hedges. It is a lot of carcinogenic chemicals, petrol and diesel fumes. It is degrading and compacting soils with heavy ride-on mowers. It is planting the same handful of plants that you will find all over this continent. Some of them will be native to some parts of this continent. The majority will be from overseas, especially from South Africa for some reason. There are thousands of indigenous species, beautiful, made for the different soil types and climates that are indigenous to this continent, yet we don't plant those. And to be completely honest, my time in the inner city with the more ritzy jobs was just a dressed up version of the outer city jobs. There was still a lot of greenwashing. I saw eco-plant walls that were supposed to be the future of our green cities whilst they required huge amounts of irrigation to keep them afloat and needed regular replacing, and there was lots of plastic involved. I saw trees die because they weren't cared for, and this inner city client was just like, no problem, we'll just pay for a new one. Just treating it as replaceable. So that's what the work can look like. But let's have a look now at some things that are common in the industry that affect workers. This is a workers' rights show. Let's talk about workers' rights. Let's start, in fact, with the vehicles we use. Garden maintenance means working in teams of 2 to 3 per vehicle. You are usually in a diesel ute with a trailer, otherwise it's a variety of trucks. All vehicles are leased to companies by major fleet companies. Remember when I said I had over 30 sites to take care of? That was a lot of driving. Now multiply that by all the various maintenance teams, all those work utes you see driving around. Driving from site to site all over the city, emitting pollution. The current plan, of course, by these major companies is to transition their fleets by leasing fleets of electric vehicles. And it's in their business plans, it will happen. EVs, however, don't represent a major shift in the way we do things, they just represent a reduction in carbon emissions. But they are not real systems change. And when electric comes to our tools, we then have to carry much heavier batteries than we used to carry with just petrol tools as well. But there is another technology to do with vehicles that's very important to mention, which is surveillance technology is now monitoring and data mining us workers. (laughs) we now punch in and out with our vehicle's surveillance system every day. It monitors when, where, and how we drive. It used to be commonplace that if you got the day's work done early, you could clock off early. That's changing now. We gotta clock off when we're supposed to. 3 p.m. If we're supposed to be at this park clocking off at 3 p.m, that's where our vehicle's gotta be, because the surveillance system will be telling our employers. It means that our bosses can analyze our work schedules, and if they see that we're getting some sites done early, they can squeeze in more sites, put in more work for us to do, and squeeze more out of us. Never mind that we might be exhausted, that we have already done what we've been paid to do. Never mind that the company is making more profit by squeezing more work out of our time whilst we are still paid the same wage, the same hourly rate. Never mind that we might have been working throughout summer in 30 degree plus heat on hot roads on medium strips. We've got one more site to get to, and if we don't get to it, the surveillance system is watching. The other issue with this surveillance technology is the use of the work vehicle outside work hours. Some maintenance companies have workers meet at the depot first thing to collect the work vehicles. However, it is becoming more common for companies to allow workers to take company vehicles home as a perk to save petrol money, with a discretionary amount allowed to drive outside of work. Wow, what a great little perk. This is also used as an argument against us during our enterprise bargaining agreement. We go into the enterprise bargaining agreement with a 7.5 pay increase requested. They say, well, we've proposed 5% pay increase, and you should be grateful because you get that vehicle perk, which is saving you petrol money. Only that perk is not evenly distributed amongst the workforce. Only those who get to take the vehicle home get that perk, get that savings and that benefit. The other workers in the vehicle don't. So they lose out in this negotiation. Furthermore, as I said, they're watching us a lot more closer now. And when the bosses see that you're driving an extra 30 minutes every day in that work vehicle, that becomes a couple of hours every week. And that just keeps multiplying with the data report that they see. Geez, maybe we should stamp down on how much they're using it. They seem to be taking advantage of our good nature, letting them use these work vehicles. Finally, and this is something the bosses need to understand, which is increased surveillance of us does not equal increased productivity. What do workers do when they're being watched and they have to spend 2 hours in one place and they get the job done in less than 2 hours? They sit in the car. They sit on their phones. Maybe they tidy something up. But they stretch out those 2 hours. At least, I hope you're doing that. And I hope you're not doing your bosses any favors. A bit of good old slacktivism as resistance is what I say. Now, speaking of workers taking a stand in the industry, what is the rank and file organizing like? Well, in my experience, very poor to non-existent. I have only heard of one company, and it's Australian-owned, by the way, in this sector, that has something going on with its rank and file. So what are the obstacles we face here in gardening and landscaping? Well, for a start, workers are alienated from one another. Say your company has 120 workers under a statewide enterprise bargaining agreement. That 120 workers will be divided between divisions of 5 to 20 teams across the state. Then those teams are divided again by twos and threes as they are split into their separate runs and vehicles. If they don't meet at the depot every morning and they've got that sweet perk where they can drive the vehicle from home, then they don't meet anyone else in their division except once a month at a toolbox meeting. And remember, that's still only one division of the original 120 workers under the same EBA. Each of those divisions has different managers as well, different levels of satisfaction with their pay and conditions. When you add that it's 2026 and it's a bleak time for trade union rank and file organizing, it's not great. but it's not impossible, and the teams aren't that huge. So the EBA bargaining period still remains a valuable time to try and connect all those divisions to get better EBAs through. It just takes planning, educating, and a lot of hard work, and that, you know, solidarity. Except, there is one problem that I've noticed in a couple companies, I've seen it, which is regional teams being set up by a project manager who's sent out to that regional area to set up the team, and then hiring all his friends, which to me would be a conflict of interest and perhaps quite useful when it comes to getting them on side during the enterprise bargaining agreements.
You're listening to Stick Together, workers' stories and union news.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, broadcast around the country every week on the Community Radio Network.
Stick together.
Yeah.
Stick together.
You're listening to Stick Together on Community Radio.
That's right, you are listening to Stick Together with me, Amy Ciara, on 3CR Community Radio or across the Community Radio Network. I'm spinning you tales today about my industry, gardening, under the Gardening and Landscaping Award in Open Space Maintenance for major maintenance companies. Let's get back to it. There is something that really should be driving workers to push for better conditions, which is their own personal health and safety. The majority of the workforce, as you've probably picked up, is unqualified. It's because the majority of the work is mowing lawns, which apparently can be learned on the job. The problem is that the responsibility of educating those workers falls on the employer. What that education looks like are boring online modules with easy multiple choice questions. But the boring ticker box education is for the incredibly important safe operating procedures for machines and tools that can easily maim or kill workers. I've in fact worked for a company where a different division had a worker try to clear by themselves the debris from underneath a ride-on mower. The ride-on mower somehow rolled onto that worker and crushed them, and they later died from their injuries in hospital. The company responded as you would expect a major company to respond. They provided support to affected workers, they supported the family, they provided serious toolbox talks for the rest of us, and most importantly, they let us know that they updated the safe operating procedures online, which we can access somewhere via the worker portal. But what needs to be happening is a proper workplace culture of practical demonstrations and oversight, making sure that workers know what they're doing, they're using tools safely, and they are properly trained in those tools and safe operating procedures. This can be easily done at any workplace today. Start doing practical demonstrations in your toolbox. Start going over one thing your team does on a regular basis at every toolbox and get everyone involved contributing on how the proper operating procedure for said thing is. All important things to revise that even old hands can forget from time to time. And this leads to another aspect of workplace culture that I've seen that affects work health and safety, which is that the majority of teams out there I've experienced and seen are male dominated. That is, despite my experience of TAFE being a place of great diversity, in truth, this is not a trade that is hospitable to anyone other than men, because the men are everywhere, and most of them like the boys' club. I've stuck it out as a transgender woman, I've made friends, and I've broken down walls, but most of my peers from TAFE did not stick it out in the industry. If it wasn't because how disappointing the work actually is, it was being the only woman, sex or gender diverse person on the team. God forbid we get too vocal about it and ruin the boys' fun. Ultimately, the industry and safety suffer from this lack of diversity. I have seen men think glyphosate, aka Roundup, won't make them sick when they don't wear PPE because, quote, she'll be right. There is only a bounty of cases internationally of cancer, birth defects, and so forth. I've seen men time and time again who view wearing the correct PPE that will protect them from serious illness or injury as a threat to their masculinity. The culture created by this lack of diversity will only continue to perpetuate itself while the diversity does not improve, and if the workforce doesn't pursue change. So, I've laid out a lot of problems so far. I've seen some change in the industry though. The pressure for that change, however, has come from outside, from the broader community and organizations. And on that note, I'd like to share a story about how difficult it is to change this industry, but how it can be done. I was driving with a friend in town, and we had driven past acres and acres of yellow lawns, barren and lifeless, while the summer sun was beating down on them. In time, the weather will improve, and they will grow new shoots. For another year of a heavy ride-on mower, chopping them down along with whatever insects that take refuge in them. My friend turned to me and asked me some interesting questions. They said, "I don't understand why we still have all these lawns when they spend half the year dead. They have no value. Isn't this just a waste of money? Like, surely there are better ways to use this space. Why don't we replace them with something useful?" Well, if you think like my friend does, then I'll tell you what I told them. You need to understand that the clients and maintenance companies think in terms of money, budgets, and what has always reliably worked for them. Let's take your typical council park that includes some kind of sports field. The local council is paying to keep it maintained to a certain aesthetic standard. If this park is special or in an affluent part of town, it will receive a bigger budget and possibly use council workers who are qualified and go through a more rigorous hiring process. But the majority of these parks' maintenance are put out to tender and bid on by the kinds of companies I've worked for. Companies, as you've gathered by now, have a less qualified, less supported, lower paid, and disenfranchised workforce. The council makes a decision about the standard they expect, which is an aesthetic standard, not a horticultural standard. There is another factor to all this as well, which is the community that uses the park. The community uses the park for all kinds of things, such as sports, play, picnics, barbecues, dog walking, community groups, and so forth. So the park was likely designed to facilitate these groups in some way with children's play equipment, barbecues, shaded areas, and hey, I guess lawns are a pretty good and cost-effective way to cater to a lot of those groups. You might be thinking the irrigation is costly, but most parks don't use their irrigation because that costs money in maintenance and water usage. So say you replace all the lawns with native grasses that are nice and tall, creating a little metropolis for native insects and animals. You're going to need trained, qualified people who can tell native grasses apart from invasive species, which can be notoriously difficult, by the way. The maintenance will likely be fortnightly spraying with glyphosate and hand weeding. It will take a lot more time to get through than once or twice a month with a zippy ride-on mower, so the maintenance becomes more expensive. But the community may give a more mixed review of this change. The community, and I know this from experience, will raise safety concerns about attracting snakes and about dangerous objects like needles that may become obscured by the taller grasses. Dog walkers will want assurance that the grasses won't grow paralyzing seeds and attract ticks. You could design a park that makes everyone happy with lots of native vegetation and no lawns, but new parks today can cost hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars to build. So there is an answer to my friend's question. No one wants to spend the money, and the community isn't necessarily united on this. The good news is I have seen local communities get the council to stop spraying glyphosate where their kids play. I've refused as a worker who knows the laws around spraying glyphosate in childcares and sensitive areas and children's hospitals after being asked to do so by the people in charge of those places, who should know better, to then only see the person who takes over that contract after me, or the company that takes over that contract after the company I was working for, go straight back to spraying glyphosate, because hey, the client doesn't care. The best I've done as a worker is refuse and let communities using the facilities know what's going on. And it's that community that can band together and make that change. Whether it's pestering their council, workplace, facility, or even staking a claim to a section of a park and doing their own thing. When you do that, you are also supporting us workers shift in industry from greenwashing as window dressing gardens to something better. Before I end today's episode, I don't want to overlook the fact that these green jobs can also be vehicles for continuing the project of colonization, for continuing the project of genocide and ecocide to First Nations people. And we have to support them in a genuine solidarity in our collective struggle to decolonize so-called Australia. And to decolonize its oppressive colonial capitalist system that ultimately oppresses all of us and gets in the way of doing the important work that cares for the environment, that cares for country. And I'd like to leave it on that note. Well, that's all we have time for on Stick Together this week. If you want to catch up with our program, the podcast is available at 3cr.org.au or at your favorite podcasting site. Do you work in one of those industries that works with ecosystems, plants, or animals? Do you have issues that you'd like to talk about on this show from your workplace? I'm hoping to create a space for us workers in these industries to have a voice and start getting the issues that we're having out there. So you can contact myself and the other producers of Stick Together at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com or by ringing 03-9419-8377 and leaving us a message. My name's Amy Ciara, and remember, wherever you are and whatever you do, there's a union for you. And until next time, stick together. Please enjoy Jesse Wells' War Isn't Murder.
War isn't murder, good men don't die, children don't starve and all women survive. War isn't murder, that's what they say when you're fighting the devil. Murder's okay. War isn't murder, they're called casualties. There ain't a veteran with a good night's sleep. Let's talk about dead people, I mean a dead people. Dead don't feel honor, they don't feel that brave. They don't feel avenged, they're lucky if they got graves. Call your dead mother, ask her when she died. It's a deadly silence on the other line. The dead don't talk, but their children don't forget. So in 20 short years, you could live to regret that. War isn't murder, there's money at stake. Hell, even Kushner agrees it's good real estate. War isn't murder, as Netanyahu, he's got a song for that and a bomb for you. War isn't murder, it's an old desert faith. It's a nation state sanctioned righteous hate. Let's talk about dead people, I mean a dead people. War isn't murder, it's the vengeance of God. If you can't see the bodies, they don't blow when they rot. And the flies don't swarm and the children don't cry. If war isn't murder, good men don't die. So in a short 20 years when you vacation the strip, don't think about the dead and have a nice trip.